now, harder than ever, we must act up, fight back, fight AIDS.
Plague. We are in the middle of a plague. And you behave like this. Plague. 40 million infected people is a plague.
Larry Kramer. As you can probably tell, he was a fighter. He did not mince words. He was a playwright and a gay rights activist, but his demand for attention and resources to fight HIV/AIDS made him a giant.
There was medicine before and medicine after Larry.
That's another voice you might recognize, Dr. Anthony Fauci, the lead authority on infectious disease in the U.S. and part of the White House Coronavirus Task Force. In the 1980s, Fauci was researching a different infectious disease that was wreaking havoc on the gay community. And that's where he first crossed paths with Larry Kramer.
He transformed the way the community interacts, not only with the scientific community, the regulatory community, and the federal government, when the federal government is involved in the research and intervention of a particular disease. He did it in a way that was unprecedented. There wasn't much attention paid, and I think that was inappropriate because the government at the time could have used the bully pulpit to really bring attention to something that was an emerging catastrophe, particularly for the gay community. Larry sensed that and used his techniques, which were very unusual and in to some respects frightening to people. He scared the hell out of the scientific community as well as the regulatory community, not to mention federal officials, because he was so iconoclastic, outrageous in the way he would confront people to gain their attention. That shook the cages of the medical, regulatory, and government community. So that's what I meant when I said nothing was ever the same after that, because it became clear that you have to get involved in your decision-making, the people who are going to be impacted by your decision-making. And it seems like that's a no-brainer now, but back then scientists were very rigid and essentially inflexible in realizing that people who are the ones that are going to be impacted by what you're doing should have a say both in the design of a clinical trial and the implementation of a clinical trial. And back then it was thought, don't bother us, we're the scientists, we're the physicians, we're the regulators, we'll tell you what's good for you, which almost seems laughable now retrospectively, but back then that's the way it was. Larry changed that.
Is there another disease that came afterward that became, to your point, one in the after Larry issue where you said, okay, we learned from him, we need to involve the people who are afflicted by this in this process, bring them to the table?
You know, I think every outbreak, with few exceptions, and I think COVID is an exception because COVID afflicts anybody and everybody. Right. But other outbreaks sometimes are selective for certain people, certain regions, certain, like for example, when we had Zika, remember Zika, if you don't have mosquitoes around, you don't have to worry about Zika, but that's not the way with COVID, because with COVID, it doesn't matter where you are. And then there was Ebola, you know, the understanding of what it meant for the people in the developing world in West Africa with the big outbreak there, and then in the Democratic Republic of the Congo in Central Africa. It's the understanding of that you've got to engage the community. Because I can remember back when we were doing Ebola, and I was deeply involved with the response to Ebola, that we had to understand the special needs of people. For example, burying them. They would not want you to essentially deal with their dead family members in a way that you felt was safe, because it was against their tradition. And unless you understood the tradition, you really had a hard time keeping the community safe. It has different levels of approach, but it's always a sensitivity to the needs of the involved people, your partners with them. It isn't the physician is up in some pedestal. The regulators are up in some pedestal, and then the afflicted people are somewhere down below. We're partners in what we do. And that's the point that Larry was making. And, you know, and it's very interesting, because to really understand Larry, Larry was very confrontative, theatrical, and I use the word outrageous, because he was. I loved him. I loved him like a brother, and I still do, that he's gone. But, and we loved each other. But he was completely outrageous. But he didn't get into the fine granular details of, now that I've got people's attention, how do I articulate what the needs are? That wasn't his forte. What he did do, which complemented the effectiveness of his outrageous theatrical behavior, was that he mentored and brought under his wing a group of young activists from the original ACT UP group, who were very academic, very serious, very scholarly. And they got into what it meant to really get involved in being part of the research agenda and planning the clinical trials to make sure that they're user friendly.
Well, that's the other remarkable part of your story, Dr. Fauci, is the fact that he called you a murderer, you're an incompetent idiot, and now, and you say, but we're brothers, we're like brothers, we were best friends. How does that happen?
When he was doing that, and I did this with other activists in addition to Larry, when they are being as outrageous and as confrontative as that, that is a reflection of the pain they're feeling and the frustration that they're meeting. And I got that pretty quickly. So I adopted kind of a philosophy with them that this isn't anything personal with me. To them, it's strictly business. I'm a public figure, and it isn't Tony Fauci, the person, who they ultimately got to know. It was this public figure. So I put that aside and said, I'm not going to get annoyed or angry or hurt. I was shocked the first time. I mean, when you're a physician and you've trained all your life to help people, and then somebody puts on the front page of the San Francisco Examiner Sunday magazine section that you're an incompetent idiot and a murderer, that certainly shocks you and gets your attention. But once I got past that, I didn't take it personally. I started to listen to try and understand what he was trying to do, was to get the attention of someone who would listen to him. And I went from an adversary to an acquaintance to a casual friend to a really good friend to a deep, deep friendship and affection over a period of decades. And that's
well, and you helped him with his liver disease. I mean, you were his doctor.
I was. I mean, he had a primary physician who was quite good, but he was getting into trouble because he had chronic hepatitis B in addition to HIV infection. And he was not doing very well at all. We would, you know, either have dinner or I'd go up there. We'd be on the phone a lot. We had hundreds of phone calls together, several dinners and a lot of visits. And there was a period of time where he just didn't sound right. He sounded like he was sinking. And I said, Larry, you know, I don't like the way you sound. And he says, well, my physicians are perplexed. They don't know what's going on. I seem to be, you know, going downhill. I said, well, let me bring you down to the NIH here in Bethesda and let me take a look at you. You know, I'll be a consultant. I'll be your physician for a month. So we brought him down, and it was clear that he needed a liver transplant. So we made the arrangements with the University of Pittsburgh for him to get a liver transplant. It was kind of historic, because then there was a big reluctancy to transplant livers into people with HIV infection. He was one of the first ones. It was not only life-saving, it gave him a significant number of additional years. And then when he went back, he continued his work, you know, his books and his plays and all the other things he did.
Thinking about where we are today, I mean, you're able now, all these years later, to look back at that era during the height of the AIDS crisis, your relationship with Larry Kramer. Now, thinking forward for what we may learn about this pandemic that we're in, is there something right now that you think, you know, I see already where we're going to be focused on some of the blind spots that we have had in dealing with a pandemic of this type.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, if you look back with HIV, it took a while to get a full grasp of what the variable manifestations are, what the precise mechanisms of pathogenesis are. And we learned you have to be humble. You know, as much experience that you have, and I've had at that time, I had already been at the NIH for 9 years, working rather successfully in other diseases when HIV came along in 1981. Of course, I came back from my medical training in New York in 1972, and 9 years later we had HIV. You know, you think you're pretty good, you think you know medicine pretty well, and then all of a sudden you're confronted with a disease that puzzles you and that you realize you have a lot to learn about. So you have to have a degree of humility. That is being translated right now with COVID. I mean, COVID, we still don't fully understand so many things about this disease. We know that it's very, very efficiently transmitted from person to person. That's clear. We know that asymptomatic people transmit it. But we also know that there's a great deal of disparity in the clinical manifestations, where some people do perfectly well with a few sniffles, a feeling of a stuffed nose, maybe a cough, a fever, and they're done. They're fine. Other people get the same virus, and then after a week or so, they deteriorate, they go to the intensive care unit, and then they die. I mean, that's very interesting. I mean, we do know that being elderly and having comorbidities like diabetes and hypertension and obesity puts you at a higher risk of a poor outcome with COVID. But it doesn't explain why one 35-year-old person would do perfectly well and another 35-year-old person would die. It doesn't explain why some children get barely any disease and others get this post-infectious multi-system inflammatory syndrome that's still very puzzling to us. So we have a lot to learn. So going through the learning process of HIV/AIDS has sort of set the stage for the learning process that we're going through with COVID.
I want to go back just a moment for, go back to the early days of researching AIDS back in the early 80s. Think about where we are now. I mean, it's 40 plus years. Did you think we would be farther along, maybe, in what we know about it, or at least to be able to have a vaccine for it?
Yeah. Well, if you put a vaccine aside, Amy, which, I could talk to you very briefly about a vaccine. It's very problematic to get a vaccine against a pathogen that the body itself does not make a very good immune response against. And that's one of the realities, but the frustrations of HIV is that that's the reason why there are essentially no people who spontaneously clear the virus and recover. Some people do better than others, but nobody completely clears the virus on their own because their immune system, for reasons that we don't understand, are not capable of dealing very well with this virus. So whenever you develop a vaccine for any disease, including COVID, I could tell you right off the bat, Amy, that it's going to be infinitely easier to develop a vaccine for COVID than it is to develop a vaccine for HIV. Because we know that the body makes a really good response against COVID. And many, many, many people, the majority, recover and do just fine. That means that conceptually, we know that the body is capable of doing that. Whereas with HIV, we don't have that proof of concept. So we've got to do better than natural infection does if we're going to make a vaccine. So putting vaccine aside, HIV therapy has been an amazing success story. I mean, I spent the summer of 1981 when we brought in the first HIV-infected person to the NIH. And at the time, we didn't know it was HIV until 1983, 84. We just called it a different name, GRID, inappropriate gay-related immunodeficiency. And then we finally decided to call it AIDS. And then a few years later, we found the virus. For those years, from 1981 till we started to get good drugs, essentially, with few exceptions, every single one of my patients died. It was the darkest years of my professional career, the darkest years of my life. Prior to that, I was a physician that was developing cures for inflammatory diseases, and my life was one success story after another with a patient, and then it was one failure after another, after another, after another. So from going from that status to having drugs now, which when given in combination with one single pill, you can get someone who's HIV to live essentially a normal lifespan, not quite, almost a normal lifespan. So those years of investment in research with HIV have really paid off when it comes to therapy. As you mentioned, we still have the challenge of developing a vaccine, but the therapy is just spectacularly effective.
And the frustrations are coming from different channels this time. There's not necessarily a Larry Kramer, but there's criticism now and questions coming from everywhere at you. Did working at that moment and working with Larry Kramer help you to be prepared for the amount of incoming that you are going to be getting?
Yeah. Actually, Amy, I'm smiling at your question. What I have said in the past, whenever I'm getting a lot of incoming, wherever it's from the community, from the administration, from the Congress, from whenever I get that, I say to myself, hey, this is a piece of cake. I've been through Larry Kramer. Don't worry about it.
Do you think he would appreciate that?
Oh, he used to laugh. I would tell him, you know, we'd have dinner sometimes and, you know, well after the peak of the HIV tension. And he'd see me in Washington, you know, in Washington, as you well know, Amy, this is your beat. Understand that you get incoming and criticized no matter what you do. A day doesn't go by that you make somebody unhappy. But you've got to realize that that's the nature of the position you're in and the job that you have to do. And I used to joke with Larry, saying, Larry, you trained me well. You threw so much crap at me over the years that anything that gets thrown at me now seems like it's second rate. So I don't worry about it.
Well, Dr. Fauci, I really appreciate you taking the time to talk with me, to reminisce about Larry Kramer. It's been wonderful talking with you.
Same here, Amy. It's always a pleasure to be with you. Thank you for having me.
At Radiolab, we love nothing more than nerding out about science, neuroscience, chemistry.
But we do also like to get into other kinds of stories. Stories about policing or
politics,
country music,
hockey,
sex. Of bugs.
Regardless of whether we're looking at science or not science, we bring a rigorous curiosity to get you the answers.
And hopefully make you see the world anew.
Radiolab, adventures on the edge of what we think we know.
Wherever you get your podcasts.